Bring us out from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
We did it. Chile's Boric has sealed a leftist revival, as it's been described, with his election win. He's a handful of leftist candidates who have won or projected to win presidential elections in Latin America. Why is there what appears to be a surge in leftist politicians to have risen in Latin America that has struck such a chord with the citizens of the respective countries? Well, in this edition of The Spotlight, we will look at Chile first, then look at other countries that have had a leftist candidate win appeal to the masses instead of a right-leaning one, like in the Honduras, Peru, Brazil, and Colombia. Well, let's find out what happened in Chile. Alejandra Kirk is our correspondent joining us from Santiago. Well, if the videos were a testament to what really happened, with tens of thousands of people out there on the streets receiving warmly their new president-elect, tell us exactly what has gone down and what Chile is experiencing right now.
Well, hello. Yesterday, 1.2 million new voters went to the polls. That was the decisive factor in Gabriel Boric's victory. These new people were actually Chile has been experiencing a high rate of abstention since vote became voluntary in 2013. This time, after the defeat in the first round of elections, the political leadership of Boric's campaign decided to apply a method used in the past against a digital dirty war by the far-right candidate Kast, which was imposing method of fake news and deviating the debate about personal traits of Gabriel Boric. They went door to door. They raised this slogan, 1 million doors for Boric, and they applied this old technique of popular activism from the 20th century. Local committees, people going door to door, face to face, talking to people, especially the young people, and this yielded this result. 1.2 million people. Boric is not only the youngest ever president of Chile, he's also the most voted ever. And this record is difficult to assess if not for a new way of doing politics. This is a generation change too. This is a break off with the Pinochet legacy. That's how I interpret this. This vote was a plebiscite on whether to continue, not only with the neoliberal policies imposed by the dictatorship and refined after the end of the Pinochet regime, but also with that culture that has been prevailing over the country and which began to be broken by the popular revolt of 2019. There is a constitutional convention working on a new constitution, and Boric has promised to support this work. This constitution should be ready by July, and subject to a plebiscite, approve or reject later on. On the political side, this is also a change of style. A young generation, most of them were student leaders of the 2011 student revolt, and they are bringing some fresh air into a system that is has been for a long time too heavy, too formal, too attached to the old habits of politics within four walls. So the promises that Boric has made about structural changes, he also has a moderate program. He's not a communist. He's not a revolutionary. He's promising a social democratic way of changing things, which has raised, of course, many doubts. Many of the people who voted for Boric actually voted against this reinstallation of the Pinochet culture in government, represented by this far-right candidate, José Antonio Kast.
Okay, thank you very much for that. We appreciate Alejandro Kirk there, a correspondent from Santiago. Well, let me introduce our guest for this edition of The Spotlight. He's a professor of Latin American and Caribbean Studies, Hostos Community College, Daniel Shaw, who joins us in New York. We also have author, journalist, and contributing editor for The Canada Files, Arnold August, who joins us from Montreal.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Okay, welcome to you both. Arnold August, let me first start with you. So what do we have over here? When we have this this man, 35 years old, they keep talking about that in the media, who was the reception he had, the number of people who came out to vote for him was unbelievable. What is your initial reaction to how he has won this vote at this point?
Well, first thing, I think that the number of people that came out to vote for him was really outstanding, because the outgoing regime of Piñera did everything to try to hinder the people, especially in Santiago, which is very left-leaning, hinder them from voting by not supplying, as agreed upon, special transportation, special buses to allow people to go to the voting booth. So despite that, he got a very, very strong support and a most important vote for a president in the whole history of Chile. I think that I'm glad that your correspondent in Santiago raised the issue of the context. I just like to underline it, that this election, they took place in the context, especially of the fall 2019. I won't say protests. They were actually consisted of a rebellion, an uprising against a neoliberal order, and the bulk of the people involved in that were the youth. So it was very important that Boric wins that election against someone, Kast, who is a son of a Nazi and also open supporter of fascism. So some people, of course, as your correspondent hinted there, you know, not everyone was so enthusiastic about Boric, because he is not really a left-winger. But just imagine today, if Kast would have won, what kind of a conversation we'll be having today, sure, and in Chile as well, as far as the outcome, how Chile is going further along the path after the elections from yesterday. So it was definitely a historic victory. And with regards to Boric, of course, it's very complicated. He has very good position domestically, for example, while Kast opposed abortion, of course, Boric supports the right to abortion, as well as other increase in social welfare. Yes.
Great. Thank you. Well, let me ask you, if I may, here, Daniel Shaw, to the common person, if you can open this for us as to what we're talking about when we're talking about a leftist, in which Boric has been described as, and then you talk about the far right, which was what his contender was, I guess, Kast, and then from where you have the previous president come. So as to set the stage for us, what different ideologies are in place here, especially regarding Boris, when he's been described as a leftist?
Good afternoon. We see once again the showdown of this battle of ideas. The son of a Nazi, as the other guest said, far-right, Bolsonaro-esque, Trump wannabe, Duterte-esque, neoliberal, in the spirit of Sebastián Piñera, the billionaire president of Chile right now until March when Boric comes into office. Boric, it remains to be seen if who won in Chile is a Bernie Sanders-esque figure, if he's slightly to the right of Bernie Sanders, slightly to the left. I mean, we know for certain this is not a Bolivarian anti-imperialist revolutionary. This is not Rafael Correa. This is not Nicolas Maduro. The first 100 days of Boric's cabinet will be very telling. Already Bloomberg is asking in the Financial Times out of London and all of the stock market analysts who will be selected as his finance minister, who will be his canciller or secretary of state. So they're already toying with the price of international price of copper. So big capital imperialism will flex its muscles if they don't like how Gabriel Boric signals, not just in his first 100 days in 2022, but right now as we speak, he's supposed to be meeting with Sebastián Piñera in a similar way that in 2016, Barack Obama had to sit down with Donald Trump so that they can signal a smooth transition. But a transition for who? For imperialism? For capitalism? For neoliberalism? What type of transition are we talking about?
Sure. Big question there. Well, I'm glad you mentioned how the Wall Street and the financial world of respective institutions even maybe are looking at who he's going to pick for his finance minister. So let me ask you, Arnold August, I mean, didn't they do that with Piñera? I mean, wasn't he a businessman? He received a doctorate in economics from Harvard, and he came into business, or I should say he came into his post 10 years ago. What did that do for the country? Did that actually do well? And more importantly, did the people receive economically the benefits of what his background had? As to what we're looking at now with Boric?
Well, with the Piñera administration, and before that, Chile was known as the neoliberal model for all of Latin America. And what did it bring? It brought a revolt amongst the young people and also amongst the unions regarding that whole neoliberal outlook. So this, I think, truly turn a page against that past. But I'd like to raise a thing talking about the pressures that are being exercised by the international media and other countries against Boric. Now, Boric, internationally, he has sort of a mixed bag. On the issue of Israel, he's very good. He says Palestine is an apartheid state and he opposes Israel. But of course, I saw this morning the Israeli newspapers and American newspapers are already screaming, help, no. The Chileans had no choice but to vote for a pro-Nazi and an Israel basher. So you already see the pressures coming in for him to change his position internationally. Now, he's taken a positive stand with regards to Bolivia. But on the other hand, one has to admit that with regards to Cuba, Venezuela, and Ecuador, he echoes the basic imperialist line against these countries and against these governments. So we have the pressure that will be coming internationally with regards to the makeup of his cabinet, how he's going to approach. Water is very important in Chile. And what will he do with that? And also, at the same time, the pressures internationally try to swing him away from supporting Palestine and supporting Bolivia. He is actually in a very difficult situation. And I hope that he withstands the pressures, not only with regards to Palestine and Bolivia, but also to revert what he had, the positions he had taken on Venezuela, Nicaragua, and Cuba, because the best way forward for Chile, based on the experience coming out of the neoliberal experiment, was to forge links with these other countries, their neighbors in Latin America.
Sure.
Which, by the way, Latin America has very close ties with China. This, I think, is the way forward for Chile. And I just hope that this is the option that he takes in the coming weeks and months.
Well, let's look at the bigger picture here, Daniel Shaw. And it was really spread throughout the media back in April 2021 when you had the elections happen in Peru with Pedro Castillo to have, claimed that. And then the news coming out, there's a leftist revival that's happening. It's spreading across Latin America, and it talked about Chile, Colombia, and Brazil, of which we now have seen Chile, to expect this shift to the left. What is going on? Is there a shift to the left? Is there a resurgence of that, I should say?
Yeah, no question. This is the second wave, the second iteration of the pink tie. But notice it's a pink tie. It's not a red tie. A pink tie could still be amenable to imperialism. Imperialism is very astute. The U.S. Embassy and the intelligence services are working overtime. In Chile, in Peru, in Honduras, how can they accommodate their interests to a more left-leaning Xiomara Castro, Pedro Castillo? They will attack diplomatically. They will attack. They could use every trick under their hat. The way it played out in Peru, within 19 days, the canciller, the Secretary of State, Hector Bejar, was forced to resign. They invented all of these excuses to get rid of this anti-imperialist Minister of Foreign Relations. So when Boric begins his cabinet picks in March of 2022, or slightly before, the Jerusalem Post just published a few hours ago, as Arnold August mentioned there, they're already accusing Boric of being anti-Semite, but of course we're not confused that to stand with Palestine is not to be anti-Jewish or to be anti-Semite. It's to stand for the self-determination of the native people of what's called today the Middle East. So those first 100 days will be telling. We have to go back to 1973 when Richard Nixon and Henry Kissinger promised that they would make the Chilean economy scream because Salvador Allende's government dared to be self-determining. So that's what's going to play out in 2022. We certainly hope that there's more of a Bolivarian integration, that these blockades, these genocidal blockades against the Nicaraguan people, against the Cuban people, against the Venezuelan people, that there's room to breathe and that the peoples of Latin America can continue to support one another.
Yeah, and I'm curious as to how this is going to play out, Arnold August, when it comes to OAS. Now, we know that OAS is heavily influenced by the U.S., and it actually has been faulted as such, yes. That it's basically that there's an imbalance there. U.S. initiatives are exercised through the member states, and, of course, the member states, they think that they're enjoying the U.S. support, whether it's financially or what have you. But do you think that the U.S. here is losing that kind of outlook amongst its members when they're seeing how, in general, the public is embracing these leftist politicians, and therefore it makes them think twice, should we go toe the line with the U.S., or, as you said, stick together with some of these other countries that have moved to the left?
Yes, I think that's a very good point. I agree with you. The OAS is definitely losing any credibility that it may have had. There's no secret that we know that the Secretary General of the OAS, which is, of course, situated in Washington, D.C., was really secretly or not hoping for a victory by a cast over the left-wing candidate. Now, I think it's quite ironic. Now, the overall mainstream media internationally, they're saying that the leftist Boric want a victory. Now, as Danny and I were saying, and yourself as well, you know, how much left he is, you don't really know. But the point is, in my view, it's ironic. By saying that the leftist candidate won, this is good, even if he's not that leftist, because it will encourage two important elections coming up in 2022. One is Brazil, and people in Brazil must say, oh, this is our chance. We want to join this tide of leftist presidents and vote for Lula. And even Colombia, the most important single ally of the United States in that region, elections are taking place there. And now there is a greater possibility that this inspiration coming from Chile, left-wing victory, would also play out in Colombia with the victory of Petro as a progressive candidate against the old line candidates and parties in Colombia. And if this takes place, these two elections take place favorably in 2022, it will be a major important geopolitical a change, not only for Latin America, but for all over the world.
Sure.
So we should be you're hoping for good results in 2022.
Well, exactly. And those are the, a couple of the biggest countries that you mentioned. But Danny Shaw, I'm sure, as you said, the CIA, the U.S. in particular, and perhaps some of the other Western countries allied to the U.S. are looking very closely at this. And, they can't just sit by idly and watch Latin America, these countries, to join forces together and perhaps move as a wall against the U.S. and the world. Not that they're going to cut themselves off, but what types of reactionary moves do you think we'll see from the U.S.? And I'm guessing, and the West maybe, and I'm guessing it's going to be on the economic side, maybe through the IMF and the World Bank, to try to push them on, try to see if they can control these countries. Am I correct to look at it that way?
Yeah, 100%. The hybrid wars are already have been unleashed against the Cuban people, the Venezuelan people, the Bolivian people. We saw the coup in Bolivia over 2 years ago. So they'll use any tactic. It could be through paramilitary outfits. Of course, the financial markets trying to freeze Chile out. And again, as Arnold said, it's too early to forecast that, but if they want to try to bring Chile to their knees, they can cut them off from any type of credit. Bloomberg already announced that the price of copper internationally is down, and they signaled to the other copper producers in the world to produce more. Imperialism is very astute, and imperialism under Biden is arguably much more dangerous. The fox is much more dangerous than the wolf. I mean, Trump was too clumsy, too much of a loose cannon, but a Joe Biden, a Kamala Harris, they can dress themselves up in woke capitalist language. But it's clear that the Latin American peoples are saying, we're no longer your backyard. It's not 1824. The Monroe Doctrine is obsolete. And as Arnold mentioned, I mean, the hopes right now of another PT Lula victory in Brazil, of a Petro victory in Colombia. But then there's the revolution, the momentum, the progressive momentum comes in stages, because so far Xiomara Castro is not questioning the U.S. military presence in Honduras. Pedro Castillo is barely surviving. His the media monopolies are attacking him left and right. He hasn't even dared to utter a sentence yet.
Sure.
About the three illegal U.S. military bases in Peru. So we'll see how this class struggle plays out in the very summits of political power in Chile in the upcoming months.
Thank you very much for that. We appreciate it. That was Danny Shaw speaking there, professor of Latin American and Caribbean Studies at Hostos Community College. Thank you so much. And also, Arnold August, thank you, from Montreal, author, journalist, and contributing editor for the Canada Files. And with that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From Mikhail Vitale, my entire team, is goodbye until next time.
insights into the Holy Quran.
Indeed, this Quran guides to what is most upright and gives the good news to the faithful who do righteous deeds, that there is a great reward for them.
In the name of Allah, the compassionate, the merciful, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Assalamu alaikum. Welcome to another edition of the program, Insights into the Holy Quran, by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hausa Seminary of Qom. Please stay with us.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين ثم الصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وآله الطاهرين. In the name of Allah, the most beneficent, the most merciful. Dear listeners, hello everyone. Welcome to another edition of the program Insights into the Holy Quran. I am Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, and in this edition, we will try to have a closer look at the 25th chapter, Surah Al-Furqan. First, let's just listen to the verses we're going to talk about in this program, and we'll be back shortly. So stay with us.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim.
In the name of Allah, the entirely merciful, the especially merciful.
واتخذوا من دونه آلهة لا يخلقون شيئا وهم يخلقون ولا يملكون
have taken besides him gods which create nothing while they are created, and possess not for themselves any harm or benefit, and possess not power to cause death or life or resurrection.
Brothers and sisters, as you were with us, we were talking about the third verse of the chapter. وَاتَّخَذُوا مِن دُونِهِ آلِهَةً. They have taken gods besides him. لَا يَخْلُقُونَ شَيْئًا وَهُمْ يُخْلَقُونَ. Gods that do not create anything while they are themselves created. وَلَا يَمْلِكُونَ لِأَنفُسِهِمْ نَفْعًا وَلَا ضَرًّا. They do not own for themselves any hurt or profit. وَلَا يَمْلِكُونَ مَوْتًا وَلَا حَيَاةً وَلَا نُشُورًا. They cannot control death, they cannot control life, nor resurrection. So, in this verse, it is stated that the reason of man's servitude is Almighty Allah's power in solving problems, the Almighty Allah's power in naughty affairs, while idols cannot do such things because they do not own any profit, because they cannot control anything. They are themselves created, and thus they cannot solve the problems of themselves, let alone the problems of the others. That's why the true meaning of servitude is the Almighty Allah's power that he has got in solving the problems of mankind, because he has been the absolute cause and he has been the creator of all human beings and all the universe. One point that can be raised in this verse is the fact that this verse starts saying لَا يَمْلِكُونَ لِأَنفُسِهِمْ ضَرًّا وَلَا نَفْعًا. They do not own for themselves any hurt or profit. If we see that the issue of loss has come before the issue of benefit. It might be because of the fact that man first fears loss, and in fact, that is why the sentence protection from loss is prior to the achievement of benefit, and this sentence has turned into an intellectual rule that everybody observes. So if all these things, like all these principles, like loss, benefit, death, life and resurrection have all been mentioned indeterminately, it is for the fact that these idols are not controlling benefit. They cannot control loss, death, life and resurrection, even in one case, let alone all people. And that is why they cannot be having the rights to be served. They do not have the rights to have servants.
We hope and pray that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala blesses us with the ability to cover more of His divine
in this
word.
Series of programs, we will inshallah discuss the Holy Quran with a thematic
approach. We will inshallah discuss the chapter.
The context in which Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala speaks in this verse is the context of mentioning the ills and problems and evils of the people of the book, the previous nations who have received revelation, and more particularly the Jew.
Now let's listen to some of the verses of the Holy Quran.
First, let's listen to a few verses.
Now let's listen to some verses of the Holy Quran.
Insight into the Holy Quran. By Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hausa Seminary of Qom.
The meaning of servitude is that you become the servant of someone, and on the other hand, he has the control of everything in his hand. If the Quranic phrase لا يملكون, they do not possess, and also the phrase لَا يَخْلُقُونَ, they create nothing, are mentioned in the masculine plural wise form, while stone and wooden idols have got no wisdom and sense, it might be for the matter that these phrases are not only about wooden and stone idols, but they are also about a group that worshipped Christ and angels. And because sage and non-sage are included in the meaning of the verse, all of them are mentioned as wise. But there is also an opposite party, and according to their opinion, it is said that for showing their weakness and inability, these phrases have appeared in terms of masculine, plural, and wise form, because it implies that they believed that these idols had intellect, these idols had sense, but it was only their false belief. These idols couldn't protect themselves from loss and cannot achieve any benefit. So, as a result, the verse has stated, لَا يَمْلِكُونَ, they do not possess, and لَا يَخْلُقُونَ, they do not create. Of course, understanding this fact a bit clearer needs a bit familiarity with the Arabic language, and discussing that more is beyond the scope of our topic. Thank you, dear listeners, for staying with us in this program. We ask the Almighty Allah to set us among the guided ones and the people of the straight path. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
don't be saddened by what you see, by all the lies and treachery. Life is cruel, but don't worry. In your heart lies the key to unwind all the secrets. This life we see.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English, for listening to us. If you have any question regarding our programs, feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Also, visit our website at parsetoday.com. Until the next program, take care and goodbye.
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Poreza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Aminolemi, Kabul.
Shahanabad, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
The largest international gathering on Afghanistan since the U.S. left the country in a chaotic situation.
The extraordinary meeting of the OIC foreign ministers was convened in Islamabad to discuss the humanitarian crisis in Afghanistan. The meeting was attended by not just the OIC states, but permanent members of the UN Security Council, representatives of the UN agencies, and the international financial institutions. Pakistani Prime Minister Imran Khan called for the immediate help for the people of Afghanistan.
The point is that if the world does not act, this will be the biggest man-made crisis which is unfolding in front of us. The OIC, it's a big responsibility on us, because not only is it the situation in Afghanistan as it unfolds, but it's a religious duty to help them.
The UN Undersecretary General on Humanitarian Affairs presented a grim picture of the Afghan situation.
Basic services that all Afghans depend on are collapsing as international development support, upon which the country has depended for so long, has frozen up. By the middle of next year, as estimated by UNDP, universal poverty may reach 97%.
The Iranian foreign minister proposed the establishment of a special fund to help the people of Afghanistan. He also called for the national reconciliation and inclusive government in Afghanistan. This was the second extraordinary meeting of the OIC on Afghanistan. The first one was also held in Islamabad 41 years ago, but the agenda at that time was to penalize the Soviet-backed regime in Kabul.
The meeting of the OIC foreign ministers came against the backdrop of worsening humanitarian situation in Afghanistan. According to the United Nations, nearly 23 million Afghans are facing acute food shortage. 97% of Afghan population could slip below the poverty line by June next year if urgent steps are not taken to mitigate their sufferings.
The acting Afghan foreign minister was also invited to the meeting. Officials say at this stage the priority is to avert the humanitarian crisis, and the question of recognition of the Taliban rule will come later. Kamran Yusuf, Islamabad.
Anger was vented outside Downing Street Sunday as Britain's ethnic minorities demanded the government scrap the controversial new Nationality and Border Bill. The bill gifts the state new powers to remove citizenship without warning or a proper appeal process. Black, Asian and immigrant families are all expected to be targeted disproportionately by the new law change, sending fear ricocheting through communities.
Basically, what they're saying is that all that we've been working for as organizations, as generations of Muslims who exist in this country, belong to this country, whatever you've done doesn't really matter. You're a second-class citizen. And that is a dangerous narrative that they're presenting us with.
The fact that even though you're a British citizen, you're still affected if you're still from an ethnic minority country. So the fact that you're a member of the Sikh community, Muslim community, Hindu community, Black community, you're not really safe here.
As members of the public, as just citizens of Britain, we are just pawns, mere pawns to them in their political games. Our lives are at stake, and that is not an exaggeration.
Despite government reassurances, critics have warned that the new bill could affect an estimated 6 million Britons who were born elsewhere or have a second nationality, and could be used by the state to punish minority citizens they want to get rid of.
The bill has already passed through the House of Commons at its third reading earlier this month. It's now been passed on to the House of Lords, where it will be debated further on January the 5th. The result of that debate could determine whether so many British citizens, particularly from ethnic minorities, can maintain their nationality going forward. Robert Carter, London.
An investigation into the confidential documents of the U.S. military has laid bare horrifying facts about the American air war in West Asia. The New York Times says it has reviewed more than 1,300 records drawn from a hidden Pentagon archive, and all that has shed more light on how U.S. airstrikes have resulted in thousands of civilian deaths in Syria, Iraq, and Afghanistan, but have gone mostly underreported. Based on the U.S. military's own count, air raids have killed some 1,600 civilians in these countries over the past years. And even though the Times does not give a figure, it does say that the military has drastically undercounted the tally. A particular case that's been highlighted is a 2016 attack on a hamlet in northern Syria that the U.S. military said killed 85 Daesh terrorists. But as it turned out later, the victims were in fact 120 farmers and villagers. The high number of civilian deaths also hints at the deeply flawed intelligence plaguing the U.S. bombing campaign, as well as the hasty and imprecise targeting that is in sharp contrast to precision bombs and eagle-eyed drones propagated by the U.S. military. It also brings into question the Pentagon's claims of transparency and accountability. Based on the report, only a few assessments of faulty raids have been made public, and surprisingly, none have found any wrongdoing or led to disciplinary action. A more recent example is the U.S. drone strike that took the lives of 10 members of an Afghan family, seven of them children, in Kabul back in August. The Pentagon initially claimed that terrorists had been killed. Then it was forced to admit that the attack had been a tragic mistake, taking civilian lives. But eventually, it decided that no one would be punished for the erroneous strike. The New York Times says it has visited nearly 100 casualty sites in Iraq, Syria, and Afghanistan, and interviewed scores of survivors to compile the report. Even though many civilian survivors now have to live with disabilities that require expensive treatment, only fewer than a dozen have received compensation. Despite such a terrible record, the U.S. keeps up with its air campaigns mostly in Muslim nations. Scott Bennett, a former U.S. Army officer, believes it is time the international community moved to stop the U.S. war machine from spilling more innocent blood.
When is the world going to stand up and stop allowing the U.S. to call every other nation a state sponsor of terrorism and say that the United States is indeed the state sponsor of terrorism globally because it is engaged in the destruction of the world? When is the world going to stand up and tell the truth?
The U.S. Army carried out more than 50,000 airstrikes in Syria, Iraq, and Afghanistan between 2014 and 2019. The aim was allegedly to eliminate militants and terrorists and bring peace and stability to those countries. But those bombardments brought nothing other than death and destruction. And the U.S. has kept killing civilians with impunity and without accountability.
Yemen's capital Sana'a has hosted an exhibition on those who have lost their lives in the fight against the Saudi-led coalition in Yemen. Thousands of Yemenis have visited the exhibition, which was held in the occasion of Yemen's Martyrs Week. The organizers of the exhibition highlighted the importance of unity among resistance groups in the region in the face of U.S.-backed aggressions.
The sacrifices made by these martyrs are great, and they came to end the injustice of the Yemeni people, and they are also a source of inspiration for various people to stand in the face of the invaders, and all the resistance groups should unite against the aggressors. Our martyrs stood against the invaders led by the United States and Israel and their Saudi and Emirati tools who seek to plunder Yemeni's wealth. The martyrs are from all segments of society, and this is evidence of the sincerity of the cause that they died to defend, and Yemenis learned from this occasion the values of great sacrifice.
The Saudi-led war on Yemen, which started in March 2015, has killed tens of thousands of civilians, most of them women and children. The war has taken a heavy toll on the country's infrastructure and pushed the war-torn country to the brink of famine.
People here say they will never forget the sacrifices made by those who stood up and defended their country against the Saudi aggression till their last breath. They say Riyadh's war crimes will not go unpunished, and Saudi Arabia will be brought to justice for its atrocities. I'm Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
Afghanistan's health system is on the brink of collapse, partly due to Western sanctions imposed against the Taliban. Authorities say the sources needed to produce oxygen for coronavirus patients have run out, so as the supplies of many essential drugs. Hospital workers are struggling with acute shortages, while they have not been paid for months.
The
US sanctions against the Islamic Emirate now mean sanctioning the Afghan people. When the health sector doesn't receive enough support, and Afghanistan's assets are not freed, people's daily life becomes difficult and health services would collapse. My demand as an Afghan doctor from world countries, especially those who have blocked our assets, is that they should have a look at the economic and medical situation of the people of Afghanistan and free the money. If the US has a problem with the Taliban, it must be solved through talks rather than by pressuring our patients.
With the winter coming, hospitals will receive more patients. But nowadays, nothing is free for them, and they hardly can afford to buy food and medicines.
Before the Taliban takeover, we used to receive food and medicines, but since the Taliban have taken power, there is no food neither for patients nor for doctors. There are a few medicines available here, but doctors say most of them have already run out.
As I witnessed, first of all, most of the doctors were absent. It is said that they are disappointed because they have been unpaid for months. Second, the hospital rooms are very cold. In addition, there is a shortage of food and medicines. Patients share their food with hospital staff. It is world countries' duties to send humanitarian assistance to the Afghan health centers.
After the Taliban took over, the U.S. froze some $10 billion in assets of the Afghan Central Bank. The White House last week dismissed an immediate release of the money. The freezing of Afghan assets by the U.S. has dragged Afghanistan into hunger and the health crisis. Afghans said they have been harmed by sanctions imposed against the Taliban. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
Migration, an ongoing phenomenon, seems to be endless. Countries around the world have always had to deal with migrants coming from various destinations. A broad range of factors contribute to the movement of people, including economic challenges, extreme poverty, or conflict. According to the United Nations, around 281 million people were international migrants in 2020. That represents 3.6% of the global population. In recent years, the wave of migration has taken a different turn as Europe and the United States have become the main destinations for migrants. Large numbers of people have tried to reach Europe from countries in West Asia, including Iraq and Syria, both witnessing wars in which the U.S. and some Western states have played a big role. The U.S. itself has faced a growing number of asylum seekers trying to reach there from Central American countries. The root causes for that include economic crises blamed on U.S. policies towards these countries. Migration has also become a source of political tensions among countries, with the latest examples in Europe. Belarus and neighboring Poland are at odds over the situation of thousands of migrants stranded at the border. The UK and France have also locked horns over the rising number of migrants trying to cross the English Channel into Britain. All this comes as many migrants lose their lives through their perilous journey. There have been other destinations for migrants too. Iran is one of them. It hosts Afghans fleeing poverty and conflict triggered by two decades of the US-led military presence in Afghanistan that came to an end just this past August. Several millions of Afghans currently live in Iran, which, according to the UN, make one of the largest refugee populations. The world body has on various occasions hailed Iran for accepting the Afghan refugees. All in all, experts believe the global migration crisis can only be tackled through a concerted effort by countries and enough determination to end conflicts across the world.
The UN General Assembly passed a resolution on the situation of human rights in Iran. Pushed by Canada, the resolution expresses serious concern over, quote, alarmingly high rate of the imposition of death penalty in Iran, including those against child offenders. 76 countries voted in favor of the resolution, and 31 countries voted against it, while 69 others abstained. Iran's High Council for Human Rights was quick to deplore what he called a politically motivated measure replete with factual errors.
There is no international rule that bans the death penalty for people under 18. Furthermore, Article 1 of the UN Convention on the Rights of the Child defines a child as every human being below the age of 18 years, unless the national law considers majority attained at an earlier age. Well, in the Islamic Republic, a child has a different definition. So it's not illegal in Iran to execute a person under 18. Yet I should add that the number of minus 18 people who receive death penalty in Iran is insignificant.
Tehran views the new resolution as a clear example of double standards at the United Nations. The Islamic Republic urged the international body to open its eyes to the devastating effects of U.S. sanctions on the health sector in Iran. Tehran says those sanctions have denied thousands of Iranians access to life-saving medicine.
Iran is the major victim of sanctions. The United States has admitted that it has put in place an unprecedented sanctions against Iran. Isn't this a violation of human rights? Then why has the UN stopped short of condemning the illegal and unilateral sanctions on the Iranian nation? If you are so concerned about the rights of few prisoners who have committed crimes against the Iranian nation, you also need to take into account the rights of millions of Iranians who cannot access medical supplies just because of the sanctions.
Tehran also referred the UN to Canada's track record of rights abuse against the Aboriginal people, particularly disproportionate violence against indigenous women. Tehran said these are manifestations of deep-rooted colonialism, which Canada has been practicing with impunity. The Islamic Republic called on the UN to avoid a selective approach toward human rights. It said dialogue and cooperation based on mutual respect and equal footing is the only way to ensure the promotion and protection of human rights at the international level.
The Islamic Republic regards itself as a major victim of rights violation, many of which, it says, were committed by the proponents of the recent anti-Iran resolution. So Tehran says those countries are in no position to lecture others on human rights, and such resolutions will only kill the chance for constructive dialogues. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Alarm bells have rung across Britain after a Conservative MP informed pro-Israel activists of new government plans to outlaw the pro-Palestine boycott, divestment and sanctions movement. The comments were said by British lawmaker Robert Jenrick during an online conference about anti-Semitism titled "Why Do So Many People Hate Jews?"
It is, I think, becoming much more of a fringe activity. What we want to do is pass a piece of legislation here, and I'm pretty confident it will be in the next legislative programme, Queen's Speech, as we call it.
Since 2005, the boycott campaign, also known as BDS, has sought to sanction all Israeli-made products produced on illegally occupied Palestinian lands. The movement has been so successful in causing economic damage to Israel that pro-Israel groups have branded the BDS an existential threat and attempted to smear its supporters as anti-Semitic.
It's a shocking decision from the humanitarian point of view, where once again the British government is standing by the oppressor, is standing by the occupier, is standing by the criminal against the victim. It's something that it doesn't surprise, but it shocks us to the how tone-deaf this government is. I have absolutely no doubt whatsoever that if anything, this government has stupidly, foolishly, ridiculously, has actually afforded far more credit to BDS than it could ever have imagined.
This development would be just the latest example of a long line of attacks that this government has carried out against Palestine solidarity activism since it came into power. If they go ahead with these plans next year, then we can expect to see large-scale protest and condemnation action taking place from the many supporters of the Palestinian cause up and down the country. Robert Carter, London.
France has withdrawn from Northern